You're listening to KRCB-FM Windsor Santa Rosa, Radio 91, online all the time at krcb.org. It's 8 p.m. Stay with us. Outbeat Radio is next.
Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, we have we will be sharing a pre-recorded interview with Reb Irwin Keller, once lawyer, once member of Kinsey 6, and currently serving as rabbi as Congregation Ner Shalom in Cotati.
Ner Shalom is having a fundraiser featuring the Kinsey 6 next Sunday night, December 11th, at Ner Shalom. Listen in as Irwin gives us some of the history behind the Kinsey 6 and sings for us in Hebrew, English, and Yiddish. You won't want to miss this entertaining and profound interview with one of our most beloved community members.
Yes, and somewhere in this next hour, we will be giving away a pair of tickets to see the Kinsey 6 perform. And you'll even hear Sheridan on her silver flute jamming with Irwin. How fun will that be? But first, as always, here's news with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralia.
I have found Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, December 4th, 2016. Out Magazine reported that an Indiana college professor, Kimberly Hively, says she lost her job because she's a lesbian and maintains that federal civil rights law should protect gay people from workplace discrimination.
On Wednesday, a U.S. appeals court will take a closer look at a gay rights case in which an Indiana college professor who says she lost her job because she is a lesbian is arguing that federal civil rights law should protect gay people from workplace discrimination. The U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago will hear Kimberly Hively's appeal of a July decision by three of its judges who threw out her discrimination case against Ivy Tech Community College in South Bend, Indiana. Hively sued Ivy Tech in 2014 when they overlooked her for a permanent position, and she was refused a renewed contract as a professor when the school administration learned that she was a lesbian. The school has denied the claims, but Hively pursues her case that no person should be discriminated of a job because of their sexual orientation.
And in Louisiana, another discrimination case was heard this week. The Associated Press reported that lawyers for Louisiana's governor and attorney general argued over limits of a statewide elected official's authority and Governor John Bel Edwards' executive order aimed at protecting LGBT rights. But the state district court judge didn't rule on Attorney General Landry's request to block Edwards from enforcing his executive order, which prohibits discrimination in government and state contracts based on sexual orientation and gender identity. He also didn't rule on the governor's request to spell out the boundaries of the Attorney General's authority. Instead, the judge asked for follow-up written arguments and said he would render a decision shortly thereafter. Governor Edwards says his LGBT rights protection order issued in April, with an exception for contractors that are a religious organization, is a statement that Louisiana does not discriminate. However, the Attorney General calls the order overreaching and argued it's unconstitutional because it seeks to establish a new protected class of people that doesn't exist in law and that lawmakers refuse to add. The Attorney General has stalled legal contracts that contain the anti-discrimination language, a move the governor says exceeds the Attorney General's authority. A similar presidential executive order signed by President Obama protects LGBT people from discrimination who work for federal contractors. This is one of many executive orders the president-elect has said he would cancel on his first day in office. And here locally, San Francisco-based Hornet, the world's second-largest gay social network, announced a new partnership with a Shanghai-based company named Ventech for the purposes of creating an international online community to link LGBT people worldwide using an app that not only connects individuals, but individuals with community organizations. With over 15 million total and 3 million monthly active users, Hornet recently integrated Vespa, the largest, most comprehensive gay city guide, into its functionality. Vespa features over 5,000 places and 300 city guides in 70 countries, and an up-to-the-minute event listing around the world written by Vespa users and the international journalists at Hornet's content provider, Unicorn. Hornet President Sean Howell said, "Gay apps have evolved over the past few years to more fully engage users who demand a richer mobile experience." And he added, "Hornet users expect to interact with other members and to be informed about issues important to gay culture." Hornet is now the number one gay social network in markets including France, Russia, Brazil, and Taiwan. The app is available for download free for Apple and Android users. And also happening here in San Francisco, a national feminist art exhibition opens on December 17th and runs through January 21st at Art Gallery in San Francisco. This exhibition features 52 artists speaking out against misogyny. Scheduled on the heels of the very contentious presidential election, the exhibition examines in raw detail how the artists react to patriarchy and shines a spotlight on women's identities and embodied experiences. Art Gallery is located at 1246 Folsom Street in San Francisco. That's between 8th and 9th Street. The gallery will be open Wednesdays and Thursdays from 1 to 6 p.m., Saturdays from 2 to 3 p.m. Admission is free. And finally, these thoughts. You know, the results of last month's election continue to send shockwaves of concern, worry, and uncertainty about the future throughout the LGBT community. And much of this worry is being fueled by a lack of accurate news and, frankly, false and heavily biased reporting in the media. Your Outbeat Radio team is committed to providing you with accurate news, and we're committed to using our time on the air to keep you educated about all of these issues as they unfold. The reality today is that we don't know what changes the new president will make, but we'll be watching closely and sharing with you what we learn. In the coming weeks, we'll be focusing our stories on decisions and events that impact our community the most, and we're dedicating our upcoming Outbeat Extras, which air on the fifth Sunday of the month, to all aspects of the greater fight for LGBT equality. Our work starts this January, a week after Inauguration Day on January 29th, when your Outbeat Radio team will come together for a roundtable discussion about strategies for how we can best move forward. In the meantime, stay connected with us on our website at outbeatradio.com and through our news feeds at outbeatnews.com. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter for daily updates about important LGBT news using links you'll find at outbeatnews.com. For a complete calendar of LGBT events and meetings happening here in the North Bay, go to our community calendar at gaysonoma.com. And again, stay connected for important news headlines we're following all week at outbeatnews.com. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greyer.
Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond. Ah.
Thank you.
Welcome.
What a treat to be back here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome.
What an entrance. Oh, that's beautiful music.
I think that's the first time we've ever done that for opening of the show.
I love it.
That's a song called Broken Hearted, and it's taken from Psalm 147, and it was written by a classmate of mine, a colleague of mine named Shir Yaakov Feit in New York. He wrote that piece recently, and it actually just won some Jewish Music Award. Mm. We did the short version of it.
Mm-hmm. If people wanted to hear the long version, where would they go? Where's your CD?
They would come to Ner Shalom. You could probably find it online by Googling him. His last name is Feit. We haven't recorded this yet. This is closest we've come to recording this.
Okay, so you mentioned Ner Shalom, and for people who don't know, could you talk a little bit about that and your role?
Sure. Congregation Ner Shalom is a very cool, very groovy synagogue, Jewish community in Cotati, based in Cotati, but drawing from around the county, but especially, you know, Cotati, Petaluma, Santa Rosa, Roanoke Park, Sebastopol. And it's one of the places that you and I get a chance to make music together more and more frequently, which is really a joy.
Yes.
I especially love it when you come with the Native American flutes and bring that in to what we do. There's something so deeply down to your toes moving about Native American flute. And bringing that into sort of the Jewish space is gorgeous. It's this gorgeous fusion of spiritual impulses. What more would you like me to say about Ner Shalom? What a wonderful community.
I'd like to know what you do there.
Oh, right. So I work as rabbi at Congregation Ner Shalom. I'm in my ninth or tenth year doing that. We're a growing community. We've been growing for the last decade, and that's in a time when synagogues and organized religion in general tends to be shrinking.
What do you think the reason for that is, for the growth?
Well, I think there's a specialness about where we are and a specialness about what we do and what we stand for. I mean, I was going to say we're a welcoming place. I hate the phrase welcoming, right? I hate that. There's something about the way welcoming has been code for, you know, we have an LGBTQ caucus or something like that. You know, we're a very queer place. I would say over a third of our membership is queer. And I think sort of an outlook of difference is kind of part of the fabric of who we are in Ner Shalom. Mm. So what we bring to Jewish tradition and the rhythm of the Jewish calendar and to understanding Torah even is our experience often as outsiders, our experience creating meaning in a world where we've been marginalized, which is a really fantastic skill that we underestimate. You know, the ability to make meaning and make purpose in a world where you've been marginalized is a skill that's going to be coming in very handy over the next few years.
Well, speaking of that and making meaning, could you just describe a little bit about what Ner Shalom did as a community right after the election results?
Mm. We held an emergency ritual. We held an emergency ritual the day after the election, and it was to give people a space and a container for being able to process a lot of our emotion. Not process, that's another word that I don't like, right? Because it sounds like we're going to turn it into something else so that we don't have to pay attention to it. But for a lot of us, the initial impact was one of grief, and grief is something Jews know how to do together. We have We have ritual around grief. Mm-hmm. We have text and ritual and prayer around grief. So we got together as a community, maybe 65 people. Mm. We sang that song, Broken Hearted, that we opened with. We sang other songs. We had some poetry. But we also gave people an opportunity to express what are the values that we hold that we're not going to let go of, the values that we're going to take into this next era with us. And hearing people around the room saying, articulating in things that we stand for about justice and equality and respect and love and was so heartening. I don't know what your experience of it was. You were there, right?
I was, yeah. I was there too.
You were both there.
Yeah, it was powerful, Erwin. It was very powerful. And you don't like to use the word process, but looking around the room and being in my own process, it felt like a process, you know, yeah. A releasing.
Yeah.
You know, the process of releasing what we were holding.
Yeah, which is going to be ongoing, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right? And we're going to keeping and feeling new things about it all. But there was something about being able to name what we hold, what we have, and not just what we lost.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that was powerful.
That was important. Yeah. And then we also did a ritual that night of offering blessing that I also found very powerful. Mm-hmm. The ritual was for people to articulate blessings and direct them at each other, you know, at our community, at our government, at our beloved departing president, at the president-elect, at members of their family. And the idea was to offer blessings that were creative and imaginative, but blessings that you would also be happy to receive.
Could you give the example that you gave that night?
If I can remember what the example was. So the example not, right, is... like thinking about our president-elect. May you be blessed to wake up and realize what a jerk you are, right? Mm. I mean, unless I really am a jerk and I really do need to realize that, that's hostility and escalation that's wrapped in the garb of blessing. But instead, may you each morning wake up and hear the sounds of nature outside your window and feel a commitment and accountability to this earth. Mm-hmm. Or something like that, right? Which is really our hopes for anybody who has power that they can wield, is that they become accountable to the people and accountable to the animals and to the trees and to the planet. And offering that as a blessing keeps us in the groove of those intentions, so that when we are tempted to just escalate, to just argue, to just decry how terrible someone else is, or all of the people being tapped for the cabinet, that we don't get caught up in sort of being children again in a schoolyard, wagging our fingers at each other. But we hold our critiques and we hold our activism in a place of blessing and in a place of spirit. And hopefully that will keep us both true to our hearts, and it will keep elevating everything we do so that we shouldn't fall into that trap of just, you know, fighting in the sandbox.
Mm-hmm. Erwin, do you feel yourself that this is the process of continuing this at some point, you know, like maybe like January 20th, you know, around that time? I mean, as for the people, you know.
Oh, to do another ritual,
yeah,
somehow, around the inauguration.
Yeah, I'm just curious what you're thinking.
Well, now that you suggest it.
No, it's not over.
Right.
Yeah.
We're going to need each other a lot over these coming years. Mm-hmm. And we're going to need to be mindful of each other. You know, this is going to raise so much stuff for so many of us. You know, everyone who's ever been marginalized in any way is going to start feeling that again, if they ever had a break from it at all. So, like, I guess that's more about sort of enfranchised white people than about anybody else. But it's going to raise stuff for people. And I think there's going to be lots of waves of overwhelm because there's so much. How do you hold, you know, with each new cabinet appointment, you know, how do you hold, like, I'm still getting over the last one.
Yes.
And what am I going to do about this? And where am I going to put my energy? So I think a piece of what we're going to need to do is, and I talked about this at Ner Shalom a couple of weeks ago, among the elements for us to consider taking with us going forward, what I'm talking about is the recipe for the new era, is specialization.
Yeah.
Right? That we don't each try to respond to everything, because that leaves us stuck on Facebook all day long and takes us out of doing some real work. And I've been very proud of friends who have posted on Facebook, I'm not going to be on Facebook today because I'm going to be calling my legislators about Standing Rock. So I'm very inspired by that. So by specialization, I mean, if we all try to respond to every challenge that's going to be ahead of us, and they're all going to be happening simultaneously, it's going to make us all panicked, overwhelmed, and ineffective. And I feel like let the people who are activists, who are children's rights activists, and people who have expertise in education or who are really moved by this, let them work on responding to the education secretary. You know, everybody find, where's your expertise, or what's the thing that really moves you? It might not be something you already have expertise at, but something that, you know what, this has been in the back of my mind, and this, you know, being a water protector, you know what, I need to do that now, and I'm going to learn about that. So learn about that and do that. And then we rely on each other to inform each other. I need you at this protest this week. Or I need you to write to someone this week. Don't try to know it all yourself. But that we stay in this web of community where we can rely on each other. And we work on our communication between us. And we trust each other that among us all, we're going to get this all covered.
Getting away from the election a little bit, I'd like to ask you about being rabbi and what you're doing right now for that.
Are you asking me about school?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So all of these years that I've been rabbiing at Congregation Ner Shalom, I haven't been ordained by any of the Jewish movements. I don't have the title rabbi. People call me Reb. And being a rabbi was something that I had wanted to do starting early on.
How it's early?
Third grade.
Whoa. So that puts you at about six or seven?
Eight, maybe nine. I don't know. Eight. Yeah, something like that. Something like that. There was something I loved about Hebrew school. There was a story I read about Rabbi Hillel as a child and the risks he took to be able to study. And I was moved by that because he was living in the time of Roman occupation, and certain levels of study were forbidden. And so I was so moved by his courage. And I thought, well, and I don't have, and for me, it's allowed. I want to do this. And there was also a way in which, for progressive Jews in America, the way that you could keep studying was by studying for the rabbinate. So a piece of my yearning as a kid might have been for sort of congregational leadership and stuff. It might have been a calling around that. But also a big piece of it was just, I want to keep learning this stuff. I want to learn more and more and more. And this is the only way to do it, because I'm a secular kid in public school. You know, I'm not an Orthodox kid somewhere. But when I finally... when it was finally time for me to apply to rabbinical school, which I was going to do in 1982, none of the denominations in the United States were admitting openly gay applicants. And I had just come out of the closet, and which was huge, which was, I mean, I think as listeners know, like, it's not just something practical. It's a huge spiritual journey and a huge spiritual accomplishment. To then, in order to study for the rabbinate, in order to do something that maybe has to do with spirit or has to do with God or something like that, to have to go back and lie felt really, really wrong to me at that time. You know, I can imagine lots of, I can imagine Trojan horse strategies. I'm just going to be in the closet and then I'm going to make my mark. And there were other people that were doing that at the time. You know, there were a couple of openly gay rabbis who had gone through school in the closet, but that's not where I was at. I wasn't willing to do it. I had a boyfriend at the time too. I wasn't willing to put him through let's be roommates again in the eyes of the world. So I let it go, and I let that that dream go for many, many years. I went on to law school in order to be a better activist, ended up in San Francisco, started the Kinsey Six, ended up a performer in drag with the Kinsey Six at the same time that I was lawyering. I gave up lawyering so that the Kinsey Six could open a show off Broadway in New York in 2001. And then I was a full-time singing drag queen for a bunch of years. And then I moved up to Sonoma County, and through a series of quirky events, I ended up taking over rabbiing at Ner Shalom. And that whole rabbinic longing came flooding back in when I had really, I had not just given it up in 1982. I had given it up over and over, because every so many years I would think, well, maybe now is the time that I can do this. But now I've got a family. Now I've got kids. Now I've got this. Now I can't do this. Whatever my reasons were. And all of a sudden, there I was, and fate kind of brought it around to me. And I began doing the work. So then, in my typical outsider fashion, right, my typical queer, I don't need your, you know, I don't need your piece of paper to be in this relationship that we all, I think, had to develop. I kind of was feeling the same way about the rabbinate. I don't need your stinking piece of paper. I'm Reb Irwin from Congregation Ner Shalom. And that's all I need. And I'm happy. And I am happy. And I was happy. But there was something that was still drawing me, just about being able to learn. And I left the Kinsey Six a couple of years ago, after 21 years. Not with the intention of going to rabbinical school. But a month after I left the Kinsey Six, there was a rabbinic conference of the Renewal Movement. And I thought, oh, wouldn't that be fun to go to? And I contacted them, and they said, this one isn't for spectators, but if you applied to the rabbinical program, we'd let you come to the conference. Can you get us an application by Tuesday? This was on Sunday or something. And I did. And they said, and they accepted me, and I had to accept them too, because I applied without knowing whether I wanted to do it, whether it was some kind of compromise of my principles that you don't need the ordination from some movement in order to work in this way, to do this work. But then at some point I thought to myself, I want this. I've all my life I've wanted this. I'm going to do it. And so I'm in my second year of rabbinical school and my 10th year of being a rabbi. It's a strange backwards thing.
Congratulations. Okay. Yeah. What a journey. What a journey.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the Kinsey Six, and you mentioned Ner Shalom. And I'd like to know a little bit about how they are related at this point in time.
I like how you do that, Cher.
Are you asking me to plug the show? Okay, because there could be deeper meanings to that as well.
And we have time for those as well.
So I should tell people who the Kinsey Six are.
Yeah, there you go.
I guess. although you can find out everything you need to know at kinseysix.com, and that's KinseySicks. The Kinsey Six we founded it in the end of 1993, at a certain moment in history. It was still in the height of the AIDS epidemic, and the original members of the group, we were friends, and we were also professionals. Two of us were lawyers working in HIV-related law and policy. One of the members of the group was a Clinton appointee to the National HIV Advisory Council. And we were doing hard work, and it was a hard time. And we decided to go in drag one night to a Bette Midler concert. You know this story?
No.
Oh, so we decided to go in drag to a Bette Midler concert to go as the Andrews sisters. We thought it would be hilarious. And we did this, and we went, there were some lesbians in drag as our escorts, little thin ties and mustaches, and we were in little camouflage poodle skirts, and people, and we thought there would be lots of drag queens there, but we like to say we were the only drag queens there other than Bette. people started applauding, and we were hamming it up, and a promoter from Olivia came up to us. So Olivia, for readers, is an outgrowth of Olivia Records, which was one of the really two key record companies of the women's music movement, and then went on to develop, sort of a travel company, tours and cruises and things like that. So a promoter from Olivia came up to us and said, "I'm doing a World War II theme party. Would you come and sing an Andrews Sisters number?" And we said, yes. And then she walked away. And then I said, except that none of us sings. But I was wrong. I knew that I sang. I was singing at the time in the chorus of the Sacramento Opera and stuff. But I had only started singing a couple of years earlier. And it turned out that all the others of us sang too and had background. But we didn't all know that about each other. Some of us were new friends. So that night we started harmonizing on the way home, and it turned out that Ben Schatz, who was another founder of the group, had like a drawer full of parodies that he had written he had no use for, but parodies kept coming to mind. And we started just making up harmonies on the way home, and we sounded decent for never having sung together before. So being, a group of controlling perfectionists, that was in December. We had our first concert on a street corner at Harvey Milk Plaza, Castro and Market in San Francisco in July. Like, we spent 7 months rehearsing to stand on a street corner. And of course, we promoted it to our friends. So we had 130 people sitting on the steps going down into the Muni station. And we stood down at the bottom and sang in drag. And people loved it. And somebody who was there told a friend who managed the youth hostel at Fort Mason. And she had just gotten a grant to bring local talent to show to the international students staying at the hostel. So she hired us to do two shows. So we wrote all new material for two shows at the youth hostel. And then Ron Lanza, who owned Josie's Cabaret and Juice Joint, I don't know if you remember that place. He had also owned the Rose Tattoo.
Oh, okay.
In San Francisco. He invited us to do some shows at Josie's. So we did a couple on our own. We did a couple with Margo Gomez. And then we were asked by New Conservatory Theater to start doing runs there. And we would write a musical. We would costume it. We would build sets. We would do 6-week runs of shows there. And it was a brilliant time. Like, we were able to do a lot, in part because it was extracurricular for all of us. We weren't relying on it for money. Mm-hmm. So everything that we brought in, we poured right back into more costumes or sets or stuff like that. So everything went into production rather than going into pockets. And it was a few years down the road from there that Ben said, you know what? Or maybe it was Jerry in our group said, you know what? I think we might be able to make a living at this. But we were all doing work that we loved and cared about that we thought was important. And we weren't quite yet ready to let go of that. And then Ben finally quit his job with the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association that he was the director of. And started working for us half-time to pull in more gigs. And through a contact of his, one thing led to another, and we got an offer to go under contract to open in New York to do an off-Broadway show. And that's when we finally all quit our jobs. I was directing the AIDS Legal Referral Panel at the time. I quit my job so that we could move to New York and do a show.
And here is a song by the Kinsey Six for you to enjoy. It's called The Group Kinsey Six, recorded in 1999 off their Boys to Girls CD. And if you'd like that pair of tickets, we'll take the third caller. Dial 584-2020. Enjoy.
We're Winnie, Rachel, Trix, and Trampolina. If you ever see a show out west, nothing sweller than Dragapella. It's the best. Get your kicks from the group Kinsey Six. Two are now you who can find groups who do-wop, a do-wop, but no one else grooves on beauty shops in beauty shop pop. We're chicks with sticks,
with sticks.
The group Kinsey Six, the Kinsey Six. If you are a thinker, you can see the sinker. We know that it's a thriller to rent. But there's ballet, Trocadero, pop, Charles Pierce, Lacage au Faux. Then there is Astoria, Victor and Victoria, RuPaul, Divine, and Harvey Firestein. Come on, Geraldine, you'll do a flip. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. When you make that, take that Dragapella trip. Ichi ni san chi. Go get your kicks.
Your kicks
from the group Kinsey Six. A doo-wah. Take a lick.
A lick
of a scoop of Kinsey Six. A doo-wah. Try some tricks.
That's me.
Oh, that's troop Kinsey Six. After the show, get your kicks.
All right, and we have one more pair of tickets to give away. We'll give this to the first caller that calls in. 584-2020.
So tell us about the show that's happening then.
So the Kinsey Six are actually coming to Cotati.
Wow.
I know, right? And will actually be performing in Ner Shalom's building, which, as some people know, used to be the Cotati Cabaret. So it's made for music, it's made for performance, and hopefully made for comedy too. They'll be doing a show called Chicks with Shticks, and it'll be a mix of material that's some of it is political and some of it is sort of parody of pop culture, and some of it will be poignant. And it's on December 11th at 7:30. So everybody should like get over there, because we all, besides like that you're going to have a fabulous time, and besides that this is a benefit that will support Congregation Ner Shalom, like, we all need to be together right now. I mean, I think the more opportunities for us to be together and laugh together and smile together and recognize each other's faces, the better. So December 11th, Kinsey Six, in Chicks with Shticks at Congregation Ner Shalom.
So the question I have is, will you be singing with the Kinsey Six?
Kinsey Five?
Kinsey Seven, yeah.
Well, you know, it's not like they've been walking around shorthanded. I was replaced. My character, Winnie, is now played by the very talented Nathan Markin, who, not only being a very talented musician and very funny comedian, also happens to be like exactly my height and build. So he fit all of my costumes without the Kinsey Six having to spend $20 on alterations. So that was a key factor in hiring him, I'm sure. So the Kinsey Six are completely whole and complete without me. That said, you know, for them to come all the way to my synagogue and not sing something, and so we decided to leave it up to the public. So when you, so what happens now is when you buy a ticket online, you are then given a voting ballot field where you will vote on whether or not I should step in and perform as Winnie with the Kinsey Six. It will be a popular vote. There will no, be no electoral nonsense with it. Of course, you know, it's probably rigged. Who knows? But so anyway, we're going to just leave this one to the public. Right now, the winning response is yes, I would love to see Reb Irwin perform as Winnie. That's ahead. And the in second place is the response, who exactly is Reb Irwin? So so anyway, there are a variety of responses, and you know, when you come to the show, you'll find out whether I'll be performing or not.
So people, if people don't know where Nar Shalom is in Katati, how would they find it? Google or?
You could. If you buy a ticket online, it'll give you the address. It's 85 La Plaza. If you know Katati's hub, it's shaped like a diamond and on one of the, and based around an intersection. And on one corner is the fire station. And behind the fire station is Nar Shalom. It's a small building with beautiful palm trees. So Google should get you there, but if not, go to the fire station.
You mentioned being in the San Francisco Opera Chorus.
Sacramento Opera. Yeah.
So can you give us a little bit of history about your own musical education?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a family of musicians. My dad was a band leader, was an orchestra leader. And I grew up with him. He was a jobbing musician. So he had his own band, and then he also played with others in Chicago. And I grew up with, you know, many nights a week, dad putting on his tuxedo and picking up his saxophone, and out he went. Mm-hmm. Kiss him goodbye, and out he went. And, you know, my sister and I played piano, and she played flute, and I played clarinet. And there was, it was funny, you know, we were a family where, and my mother played piano, and we all sang, and there would be times that, you know, I would sit and play piano, and my mother would sing, and my dad would play sax, or we would all harmonize together. So there was a lot of music making in the house, or we would drive in the car, and we would harmonize with each other. And it was just oddly kind of expected that that's the family business. Like, that's, you know, there wasn't any, like, my, you know, you'll be a lawyer, you'll be a doctor or something like that, that other kind of that era, upwardly mobile Jewish families might have impressed on their children. Mm. You know, dad wasn't a professional in that way. He was a musician, and his friends were musicians. And my sister became a musician. My sister went to, she became involved in the women's music scene. She became a bass player, electric bass player. Mm. And she's been in the business for, I don't know, 40 years. She was Diana Ross's bass player for lots of years. But also used to play with people at the women's music festivals. She toured with Michelle Schacht. She toured with Rita Coolidge for a lot of years. And she's made a living for herself as a woman playing electric bass, which is not an easy thing to do. The music industry is really, really male dominated. And I gave up playing at the end of high school, towards the end of high school. There had been a weird homophobic incident in the band. And that was the one place where I had felt safe, and suddenly it became unsafe, and I quit. And I didn't pick up my clarinet again for decades. And although I kept playing piano, after I moved out to San Francisco, I reunited with my childhood cantor, the cantor from my synagogue, now lived out in San Francisco with his partner, and was cantoring here. And so I was like the gay kid that, you know, so he was sort of like being the shepherd and making sure to stay in touch with, like, any of the kids from the synagogue who ended up coming out, blah, blah, blah. And I had a little period where, when I moved out, I was working for a corporate law firm, and I got laid off of that job, and I broke up with my boyfriend in the same, within 3 months, both those things happened. Big Saturn return. And he was, and my cantor friend was worried about me. And he was also directing the chorus of the Sacramento Opera. So first he got me singing with him at synagogue. And then he said, now I want you to audition for me for the opera, which I did. And I started singing in opera productions. I had never been on stage before, you know. And I remember that opening moment in the, I don't know if you've been to the theater in Sacramento, but I don't know, it's 1,000 seats or something like that. And that, and it was sold out. And that first moment when the curtain opened and I felt like a wave of air from the audience hit me that was a different temperature than what the stage had been with the curtain closed, but also had sort of the exhalation of 1,000 people eager for what was about to happen. I'd never experienced that. Opera, of all things. So I did a little bit of that, and then the Kinsey Six started. When I finally quit my job with AIDS Legal Referral Panel to go off Broadway, I was worried about what my parents would think. Because, you know, they had paid to send me to law school. Law school had not been one of their goals for me, but when I said I want to do this, you know, they helped me do it. And I had done it for whatever, 12 years, and now I was going to go be a singing drag queen. And I called my dad on the phone, and I said, we got this offer, and I'm going to quit my job and do it. I don't want to look back and think I had a chance to be a performer off Broadway, and I said no. And my father says, oh, so now both my children are performers.
Oh.
With this real tone of pride, you know, like, I had finally come back into the family business, even though I was doing it in a wig and heels, not the way that he would have imagined. We were now back to being a family of people who made music for the world, you know?
Boy, that really touched me.
Me too, yeah.
What a great response. How did you feel in that moment?
I was so happy. I was so happy.
Mm. Has he always been accepting your dad? I mean,
you know, my folks grew a lot in their lives. I mean, really give me... Oh, okay, the waterworks are starting here.
We love touching moments.
We'll let your radio audience guess which one of you it is. Or do they already know?
They know.
Oh, they do know.
But I get touched too. I'm not of stone. But anyways.
My sister came out in 1975, which was pretty early, you know, in a certain way. And my parents were very upset. They had no point of reference for this. You know, my father's only point of reference was that he used to, in one of the bands he played at one of the clubs in Chicago, there would be couples that would come where he would realize that the woman was a man in drag. That was his only point of reference. You know, he had never met a gay person knowingly. And my parents, and it was a very hard road for my parents with my sister. And I was sort of coming into my realization that, you know, oh, these various feelings are not going away. And she and I decided, my sister and I decided that I could never ever come out to mom and dad, that it would kill them. And we really believed that. We weren't saying that in a metaphorical way. We really believed that somehow it would kill them if I came out to them. And then I got involved in a relationship, and my boyfriend was not willing to keep masquerading as a roommate. And, you know, and it was a period where I was very torn. And he was very insistent, and he was right. Even though I wasn't certain at the time. But I came out to my parents, and I came out armed with leaflets from PFLAG. And, you know, it was already 7 years after my sister had come out. It was already 1982 when I came out to them. So things had changed already in that period of time. There were more resources. There were books. There were groups. And within a year or so, we got them to go to PFLAG. You know, we had kind of delivered an ultimatum that, you know, this is who we are. So if you love us and you want to be in relationship with us, there's stuff you have to do to make that work. And so they started going to PFLAG, mm-hmm. and they became, and my synagogue, the synagogue I grew up in, there were no suburban chapters of PFLAG. They had to drive into the city. And my synagogue called my parents in 1991 and said, would you be willing to start a PFLAG chapter here? Mm. Which became the North Suburban chapter of Chicago PFLAG. And it's still going strong. And it's still housed at my synagogue. Wow. 25 years later. So my parents were the founders of that chapter and were kind of the elders of it. Mm. And, you know, people kind of, they stayed in far longer than they needed to if they were only in it sort of for self-help in a way. Mm-hmm. Because they loved, first of all, you know, it was for a lot of people of a certain era, well, you could live or imagine that you could live a certain kind of unexamined life. So for my parents, as white suburbanites in the late 1950s and 1960s, there wasn't anything that was forcing them to look inward at what do I believe and why do I believe it. You know, they had certain beliefs. They were, you know, fairly, you know, progressive, liberal, Jewish kinds of beliefs. But then when they hit this wall, the queer wall, that was the one where they didn't have any tools. So suddenly they had a community of peers with whom they could speak from the heart. And they hadn't had that. They had only had people from whom you speak from the script. And that was huge for them. It opened up their lives in so many ways. And also what started happening, especially after my father died, all of these young people, people my age and younger, would come to PFLAG with horrible stories about their parents. And they would kind of glom onto my mother, who would become kind of the foster mother to everybody. Wow. You know, and she would be, and my sister and I both at that point, by that point, lived in California. And we'd be trying to reach my mom on a Sunday. Oh, I'm out to brunch with so-and-so and so-and-so. There would be all these queer people our age. We're like, who are these people that are like, you know, my mother's Thanksgiving at so-and-so's house, you know? And so she had this community of surrogate children.
That's wonderful story, especially when, you know, when your spouse passes and a lot of people don't know what to do with themselves. And here your mom had purpose.
She had this community. She had this purpose. And she was able to deepen into it as well, mm-hmm. By being more available to it than she had been, you know, when my father was sick, which he was for a number of years. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was huge. And it gives me, it's a story that gives me lots of hope. Also, just in this moment, too, about the ability of people to change in beautiful ways, mm-hmm. and to deepen and to find the value in looking inward and checking in with what do I believe and why do I believe it, and to be able to transform through that, mm-hmm. through that process into being more open and welcoming and loving and appreciative of difference. Mm-hmm. So it can be done, and it's going to be done.
More.
So here we are at the end. It goes really fast. For some reason, it goes really fast, but we really enjoyed having you, Erwin. And we like to end the show, all our shows, with advice, because we believe that each of us have advice or some offering to offer the community. And a man with such wisdom as yourself,
order.
So what advice do you have to offer?
Well, maybe a few things that have been on my mind. Simple things, really. One is don't panic. Because panic doesn't help us. Panic is staying in your powerlessness, in your vulnerability. We need to I think we need to respond to things. Of course, we need to be aware of what's going on. We don't need to panic. Another piece is to be in community together. And I was joking a couple weeks ago in a sermon when I said, I can't think of anyone I'd rather be marginalized with than this lovely group of people. The truth is that if we have to refashion this world, if we need to create a new reality in this country, we need each other. And that means we need to not just be suffering together and not just be protesting together. We need to be enjoying each other and laughing and talking and feeding each other. So it's not a time for finger wagging on the left. It's a time for actually enjoying each other. And that in itself is a powerful act. And the last thing is this. It's a good time to do creative stuff. Write a song, or make a painting, or draw a picture, or cook something nice, or garden. And the reason for this, I think, is twofold. One is, those kinds of activities give us an alternative to reading our news feed on Facebook. But also, it gives us real-world practice in taking a beautiful idea and turning it into reality, in making manifest what we can imagine. And so then when we're called upon to do that on a cultural level or a societal level, we already know we can. So do something creative. Do something creative.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Erwin, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I love seeing you everywhere I see you, and now I get to see you in lots of places.
Yeah.
But it's nice being here with you too.
Yeah.
And that was Reb Erwin Keller speaking. And here now is a beautiful poem in Yiddish sung by none other than Erwin Keller. And something he doesn't say in his introduction is that the music was written by himself and his good friend Lorenzo Valenzi. Enjoy.
Setting of a Yiddish poem by a poet named Rachel Koren, who lived in the Soviet Union and then later in Montreal for the rest of her life. And it's a poem about how through a song or poem, the things that we miss are still visible to us, and that through a song or a poem, there can still be hope even in dark times. Von jener Zeit lieb ist das Sod voran, und in Sod ist ein Haus mit der Streu an dem Dach. Es stehen drei Sosnes und schweigen sich aus, drei Schumrim auf ständiger Wach.
How beautiful. What a wonderful time we have with Erwin. So, if you want to get tickets for the Kinsey 6 performance, go to shalomevents.org. And also check out Erwin's blog at erwinkeller.org.
And remember, like Erwin, you too can be living proof that through sharing your passions, you can use your creativity as another way to help the world. You too can be visible and vibrant in telling your story. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then, good night.
Support for Outbeat Radio and KRCB-FM comes from members and from Sonoma West Publishers, bringing you the Sonoma West Times and News, the Healdsburg Tribune, and the Windsor Times, your weekly source for local news, events, and community affairs. You're listening to KRCB-FM Windsor Santa Rosa Radio 91, online all the time at krcb.org. It's just before 9 p.m. Stay with us. Open Space District is next.
Genug sich gespielt schon. Du sehst nicht. Es ist nicht.